Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Now, any time a new restaurant opens, it's something to celebrate. But we're going to be talking today to the principals involved with a new Pittsburgh restaurant called Block 292. And I'm highlighting this because it represents a nationwide trend, which is combining a restaurant with all of its sustainability, the products and the sourcing, with an on-site butcher shop, which I can hardly wait to be able to go in and pick up my Jameson lamb.
There you go. And it turns out there's a double connection here, because John and Suki Jameson are going to provision the butcher shop associated with Block 292. But it turns out somebody rather close to them is the chef, their daughter Eliza. So everything, all these people are all sort of mixed up together.
And Mark Broadhurst.
Yeah, so let's start with him since he's going to be the owner.
I mean, it's Brooks, his brother's Mark.
Right. We saw Mark the other night. That's why it's confusing.
Yeah, that's why.
So anyway, here's Brooks Broadhurst and a cast of thousands talking about the new venture, Block 292.
Well, we have a very accomplished, talented, and experienced crew on the line here talking about a new restaurant that's underway or about to open in a few weeks in Pittsburgh's Mount Lebanon section. It's called Block 292. I would say that the person who owns the building should start out. That's Brooks Broadhurst, telling us about your motivation and your mission with this restaurant.
Well, thanks, Ann. The location is an old gas station right up the road from where my wife and I have lived for about the last 15 years. And the owner, Jim, put it up for sale about a year and a half ago or so, and I always thought it'd be a great location for something. And when we decided to buy the place, we started talking with friends like John and Suki and Eliza, and have kind of worked towards what we think is a really great location once we open up.
Now, you're not exactly a novice in the restaurant business. I mean, your family has been in for how many years, the Broadhurst family?
Well, my father has been, acquired Eaton Park back in the 70s, and so I've been with the company there for over 20 years and just recently stepped away from my duties there. This would be kind of in between, if you will, a white tablecloth and casual. You know, I think we want a neighborhood feel, but on the same end with the food that Eliza will be putting out of the kitchen, much closer to a fine dining operation.
Now let's introduce the other parties on the call who are all involved in this business venture as well. Who do we have out there?
I always speak first. You know.
Okay, John.
this is John Jameson with Jameson Farm.
Who makes a little lamb in his spare time.
Yes.
Can I say something?
Yes, absolutely. Please do. Now, mm-hmm. this is Eliza Jameson, who's the chef at Block 292, right, Eliza?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
The restaurant is in town. You're going to have a butcher shop attached to the restaurant, right?
Correct.
Yep.
And who's going to have anything to do with that? I wonder if they might be on the phone.
Yes, well, that's where I started, but my daughter is always butts in, so she's well trained.
I apologize for that.
No, you did. That's fine. And then, so Suki is about to jump in, but Suki and I have operated Jameson Farm and Jameson Packing for 30 years, so we've seen a lot of lamb, and in this operation we're going to be doing other meat as well. So it's very, very exciting for both of us.
Now, you're going to have a butcher shop, right? You never had a butcher shop before.
The butcher shop will be down in Mount Lebanon at Block 292. So
exactly,
the concept will be that John and Suki will kind of manage the back end of getting the animals into us at Block 292, and then from there we will break them down and sell them retail at the location.
And
that's right. We're sort of, to specify that we're sourcing. Suki and I will be sourcing everything with and from local farmers in this area, and then we will process the meat in primals, and they'll be, those primals will be delivered to Block 292 for further butchering with Eliza and the crew.
Now, if I just want to buy a rack of lamb or a leg of lamb for myself to cook at home, I can also get that from the butcher shop at Block 292.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, Eliza, you're going to have some fabulous products to work with, but you're going to have more than the meat, right?
Yeah, there's going to be fish as well, and there will also be vegetarian item on the menu.
Okay, and who sources the fish?
Right now, I'm getting, right now we're looking at Samuels and Sons, and we might change things depending on, what's most readily available and what's seasonal and what's, sustainable. Mm-hmm. So it's always, it's going to change based on what's available, for sure.
Yeah, now you are a CIA grad, and you've worked at some very famous places, particularly in New England and New York, and where else?
I was Maine, New York, Florida.
At Primo.
Yeah, I was at Primo for a long time.
But you've been all over the scene in New York, La Bernardin, all kinds of places, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I've been in touch with Rod Mitchell. So, maybe you can occasionally get stuff from Brown Trading.
Okay. That's a good source. Wish I could.
For the most part. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be Samuels and Sons to start with, but, if you want to do specials, I would use him because I've known him for a long time and I've worked for him.
Uh-huh.
So it just makes it a little more simple.
Now, you were gone for so long. How long have you been back in Pittsburgh?
Since September.
I see. So you've been here for a while. And what do you think has happened with the dining scene since you've been gone and you're back now?
It's a lot different than when I was, before I left, it's a lot different. But there's, yes, it's progressive, but there's more progression that needs to happen.
And you're going to work on that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. What you're going to push in what kinds of directions?
Sustainability.
Uh-huh.
And, not necessarily the nose and tail, but the sustainability, the seasonality, and I don't want to say farm to table because that sounds like a generic term.
I know. We just interviewed somebody about the meaning of artisanal. He wrote a book about it.
I don't want to label it as that.
That's good.
And I don't want to necessarily label it as progressive, but
you're
going to
be doing
forward and.
But you're going to be doing things that are new and exciting for Pittsburgh, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Are you kidding me?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we're talking Mount Lebanon, right?
I know what we're talking about, but it's not going to stop me.
Yeah. Do you have any particular dishes that you have on your menu that you're going to open with?
I have a couple menus that Brooks has. He can probably email them over to you, but I have a couple of dishes that, will be great to open with, and then we can progress from there.
You don't want to tell
and
us?
Become, no.
Secret.
Brooks, how about you tease us with a couple of things that you know we're going to love?
Well, I think, Eliza's put together a really nice list of products and one of the things that we've talked a lot about is really focusing on, we don't want a big menu, we want to be able to rotate through, and by keeping it smaller, allowing Eliza and her team to continually work on new products. We don't certainly want the menu to get stale. And as Eliza was mentioning, really focusing on, you know, we're going to call it seasonal in a way. We want to stick with what is fresh and what is available. Uh-huh. And if we find something that's...
Seasonal and sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because we don't want to use the farm-to-table tag on it.
No, we haven't talked at all about the atmosphere of the place. What kind of... It's in an old service station, did you say?
It is an old service station, so it was actually built back in the 1930s and was a gas station until, which was serving, you know, selling gasoline until the 70s, which then at that point it just became a auto repair shop. And Jim and his family, Beery, ran it for many years, and most recently he would repair foreign cars, Porsches and Volvos and some other products. And so while we've kept a little bit of the interior, we've really... want to have a very clean operation and clean feel inside. So there's a fair amount of tile, some marble, a lot of wood. We'll keep some of the exposed ceilings, but it's not going to be in a theme of kind of an auto station or auto body repair place. We really want to have a very nice, bright, clean, and professional looking finish.
Yeah, and what about you? Can have wine?
We will have a full bar, beer, wine, and liquor.
Huh. See a lot, Judy.
What's that?
I think that's an somebody who's outside of the conversation is joining in. I think I seem to recall that there's a restaurant that I went to. I think we might have gone there together called Asterix and Obelisk in Newport, Rhode Island. Which was in an old service station, and they kept the tile from the original service station inside, just as you are, I guess, thinking about doing.
Yes.
So now, but let's go, Suki and John. I mean, I can't imagine that you put you have so much on your plate already. It just seems a lot. You're going to do not only you're going to source everything, are you?
We're gonna provide the beef, the lamb, and the pork.
Oh, okay.
And goats if he wants them.
Oh, goats. That's great. I'm there. That sounds great.
Later on, that's a new product, I'm sure.
Yes.
Okay. And the are people going to be able to buy offal?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Every animal has it, so he comes with it. When he buys whole animal, that's what he's going to get.
Well, this is another great addition to Pittsburgh, then. Are you going to do classes?
That would be something that would be great to push in Pittsburgh, because it's not on anybody's menu that I know of.
I don't know either. I mean, I guess maybe Legume has a few things sometimes, but not much. What about... Suki, you teach a lot. Are you going to do classes?
Am I going to do classes?
Yeah, at the butcher shop.
Oh. I don't know. That's a new concept.
We might have Suki in every now and again. We've talked a lot about internally about the idea of having, you know, some training sessions and different things down there. People want to learn about animals and how they're broken down, and so Suki would be great at that once we get up and running to talk about doing things like that.
I think it sounds very exciting, so people should start looking for it to open in about 3 weeks or so.
Yeah, probably mid to end of July will be close. Depends upon how everything progresses and hiring. We're going to start doing some more substantial hiring for front of the house folks in the next week or two.
Brooks, what's the website going to be?
It is block292.com.
There we go. That's easy to get. So an announcement of when the opening actually happens, that will be the best place to go if people don't read about it in the paper?
Absolutely, yes. And we have that up already, and then it'll change as we get closer to opening. But
great.
We do have some updates on there, and I have a Facebook page and some of that other stuff.
And please keep in touch with us and let us know so we can put it up on our website, too.
Absolutely.
Well,
will it be reservations, or is it you take reservations or walk-in, or how is that work?
Currently, we're going to use the no-wait system, which eventually people will be able to go online and or on their phone or an app and put their name on the list. One of the things we're really concerned with and we want to really attract is because it is a pretty tight neighborhood, Mount Lebanon's a walking community. It's part of a small little business district on Beverly Road. We really want the local neighbors to be able to come in often and, you know, at a last minute, not necessarily having to worry about, you know, planning a week or two in advance to get reservations. So at least in the beginning, we won't be taking reservations, and we may change that as we go along, but we really want to keep that neighborhood feel, allowing the folks that live nearby to be able to enjoy us as much as they can.
Yeah, so they haven't been.
Brooks, I don't want to interrupt or this conversation, but we're doing the etiquette for the children, for the school.
Oh,
yeah.
Are you?
Yeah, we have. We talked about across the street from us is Lincoln Elementary School, where there's 450 kids that go to school, and Mount Lebanon doesn't have buses, and so in their elementary schools, in their fourth and fifth grade, they can leave school and go out to eat at places. So what we've talked about is if people wanted to come across the street as children, they would come to us first and take an etiquette class. We'd offer a little class about, you know, how you order from at restaurants and how you tip, and, you know, parents would not be invited, and kids could come across either fourth or fifth grade to enjoy our food and get a little bit of, you know, how to act and how to be in a restaurant.
Oh, that's Charlie Trotter used to do that, didn't he?
He did initially.
Yeah, well, it's a great undertaking. Well, I don't know. Is there something we should mention we haven't yet?
I don't have anything else necessarily. John or Eliza or Suki, anything?
No, we're just looking
forward to it. Very excited.
Yes, we all are. Thank you for talking
to us.
Just
want to get in the kitchen.
Pardon?
That's what I have.
Just what? What did you say, Eliza?
Can't wait to cook something.
She's waiting for the kitchen to be ready.
Oh, yeah. We went to a dinner for a new restaurant that didn't even have the kitchen open when they had the dinner. Anyhow, well, I thank you for talking to us about it. And good luck, and I wait to hear more news.
Well, thank you, Hannah Peter.
And thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thanks, Eliza. And thank you, Brooks.
Looking forward to
and,
end of July.
Thank you for taking the time.
Yep, and...
And we've got more interesting and exciting stuff right after the break, so don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, you know, I keep reading in the various national journals about Pittsburgh at the cutting edge of everything, and I don't know. All of a sudden, I started paying closer and closer attention, and in fact, we are. We just ventured forth to one of our model programs is the Falk School of Sustainability, or it's a Eden Hall project attached to Chatham University, and it's a fascinating program, and we have an absolutely superb, experienced dean who happens to be English, kind of from close to where Peter's from.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah, and it's Peter again, Peter Walker in this case. We talked to him, we talked to their resident chef, and I think you're going to be really amazed at how much is going on in this operation. Peter Walker is dean of the Falk School of Sustainability of Chatham University, and we're currently in the Eden Hall campus. Peter, it's so beautiful. I'm embarrassed I haven't been here before. Tell me where we are, and then tell me what exactly is the school.
Well, Ann, we're about 18 miles north of Pittsburgh here in Gibsonia, and we're actually at the highest point in Allegheny County. We're very lucky. This new campus is about half a mile north-south, half a mile off either side. It's formerly the estate of a guy called Sebastian Muller, who was part of the Heinz Empire. He left it to the Eden Hall Foundation and they in turn gifted it to the university. And we've created up here what we think is the country's first sort of bottom-up built sustainable campus with all of the systems and all of the features that society is going to need in the future if it's going to be sustainable.
For those who don't have an idea or have a very loose idea of what you're talking about in terms of sustainability, could you break out some of the definitions of it and the features you have here and the kinds of courses you offer?
Sure. Well, sustainability in many ways is really easy. It's, I sort of say, it's what my granddad used to do. Waste not, want not. Many of our systems today assume that oil will last forever, that you'll be able to mine this mineral or that mineral forever, that the value of your life or your happiness depends upon buying and rebuying the latest model. Yet all of the research says, well, that's not how the future is going to be. We've got to find better ways of recycling, of not wasting, which actually is good economics, right? If you don't waste things, you make more profit off a process. So a lot of sustainability is about saying, how do we make better use of our environment, do less damage, and create a society where wealth is fairly evenly distributed, so you don't get a few very rich and a lot of very poor people. And how do you do it in a way that safeguards our children and our grandchildren so that they have similar lives? And effectively, we teach courses and degrees around that. How do you build the sort of future we're going to need?
Now, you said, and I think it's practically synonymous with the mission of this project, is that the campus, the whole campus is a classroom. Could you spell out some of the systems you have in place? Because they're fairly amazing.
Sure. So here's the thing. If you're honest, most people don't learn much sitting in a classroom. You learn by having fun, by making mistakes, and by doing things. Yeah, book learning helps as well, but it's really practical. That's how most people learn most of their lives. And so that's what we're trying to build into the academic agenda here. So, for instance, we have a farm on campus. We've got sort of intensive horticultural areas. We've got normal sort of larger fields. We've got solar tunnels that are heated by solar power all the year round. We've got greenhouses. And we build those into our courses. So students actually do work in those. We have energy systems. All of our electricity comes from solar energy. We have a geothermal system for our heating and cooling. So effectively, we take the heat that you'd normally waste in summer, you know, just pump out into the air, and we essentially pump that heat underground in a water pipe so it heats the ground up, and then you can extract that in winter when you need it. And all of these systems make the campus more sustainable, and our students actually go out and learn off them. So if you're going to be learning about the physics of solar arrays, don't just do it from the book. Actually get out and climb up on the roof and see how it works.
Now, you pretty much put this all together from scratch, and it's a work in progress. You have, how large is the school? How many students? What kind, you have various degrees, undergraduate and graduate. Tell us what those are.
Well, the school's been going only for a few years. This property was acquired in 2008. We cut the first sod for the new building in 2012. And actually, this last year has been our first real year up here. We've got about 110 students now in graduate and undergraduate programs. So we do an undergraduate in sustainability studies and a graduate in that. And then we do a graduate program, a very popular one, in food studies that looks at everything, the whole cycle, right from when you plant, nurturing the plant, converting it to animals, if you like, via food, right through food processing, the whole retail industry, restaurants, right down to the culture and anthropology of food. So I sort of joke that whenever I go down the Strip District, I sort of can't go into a shop without seeing one of our graduates there, because they're very entrepreneurial, right? And they really want to change the way we think about food and the way we think about food systems.
So right now, the students who are coming here, they're already enthusiasts, and that's why they choose to come here. And then when they're done, where do they go?
You're right. We tend to get a sort of cadre of students who are pretty committed. It's not just an academic agenda with them. It's almost a lifestyle agenda when they come here. I guess they go into a number of places. We see maybe a third of our students starting their own enterprises. We see students going in to work in the not-for-profit sector, which is actually one of the fastest-growing employment areas in the United States. We see students going to work in other food businesses in this area, everything from farms right through to restaurants. On the sustainability side, just about every corporation now has a sustainability officer, and many of our students go on to do those sorts of things or work in, say, the public health field where environmental health is becoming a lot more important. And, of course, in Pittsburgh, with the mayor's sort of push to make Pittsburgh the sustainable city of the future, there's a whole slew of jobs starting to come online there where our students are just sort of set up to take those sorts of jobs.
Now, I need for you to explain a little bit the connection between this program, the school campus, and the legacy of Rachel Carson, who her homestead, I think, was left to Chatham, and Chatham was early interested in this. You are organically certified here. I mean, it all goes back with... started with the Silent Spring, but how do you interact with that?
So Rachel Carson was actually a student at Chatham. She was an undergraduate student here, so that's where the connection really starts. And her whole philosophy was around really understanding, through good science, what impact we have on the environment and what that means for future generations. So in many ways, she was one of the first people to think about sustainability. And she was also a great communicator. So she understood it's no good just having charts and tables. You have to be able to tell the story. And that's something we're also very passionate about here. If you can't communicate your ideas, they just sit on shelves. So we've taken that legacy, and we hope we're running this campus, if you like, and this school in a way that she would be proud of. And in many ways, food systems and agriculture are at the heart of this legacy. There's nothing connects you more with your environment than your food, because there's no alternative. That food comes from the soil. It comes from the sea. You have no other way of doing it.
I'm intrigued because I think back in the 30s, didn't the president of the U.S. at the time promise that Americans could have 2 acres and a cow, and the government will give it to them? And we have a friend, a very good friend, Michel Nichan, who has developed an interest in sustainability and different ways of organizing food programs, and he would like the same thing. But it worries me that we really don't have enough land and we don't have enough money for that kind of arrangement to take place. How do you get this to scale so that whole states and whole countries can run in a sustainable fashion?
Well, that's a pretty big question.
Yes.
There's a number of ways of looking at this. One of the ways is to say, well, what do you choose to eat? So if you choose to eat beef, for instance, you're going to eat a pound of beef, right? That pound of beef has taken somewhere between 7 and 10 pounds of grain to produce the beef, plus a huge amount of energy, huge amount of water. In other words, it's a really inefficient way of doing it. Yeah? So if we all went vegetarian, which we're not going to do, but if we did, you would need a lot less land, right? We get a lot of our food from overseas. We spend a large amount of money on transporting food around the world. And okay, that means that I can get oranges all year round, but if you just go back 2 generations, food was seasonal. And there's actually a certain pleasure in waiting for those first strawberries. So there's a real move now back to saying, well, actually, can we build more local food systems, which would be good for our local farmers, good for the local community? It's also about growing what's appropriate on the land. Some of the new research around organic farming, for instance, says you can actually get yields up to about the same level as conventional sort of high oil and chemical-based farming, which is what happens in most of the states. the trick is going to be to make the economic connections between those farmers and food consumers more direct. Well, I think one of the biggest problems we have inadvertently created over the last two generations is our food is so cheap. I mean, it really is so cheap that the profit margins in farming and horticulture, they're down to what, 2-3%? Well, if you ran a business, you know, outside of farming on a 2% profit margin, you'd be laughed out of town. So all that, it's a real problem. So one of the things to be looking at is how can you increase that profit margin for farmers? And often that means in an area like this, farmers diversifying. So a farm also becomes a holiday destination with holiday cottages. It becomes somewhere that kids go for educational experiences. It becomes a producer of wind energy or solar energy or of biofuels. So the modern farmer doesn't just produce food. They're actually a really sophisticated, multiple-producing economic unit. It's a much more complex and fine-tuned economic model than it was 20, 30 years ago.
I'm going to do a little full circle here, which referring to your background, I mean, you were in worked for years with the disaster relief, more or less. I mean, you'll explain it better than that. But you pointed out that you wouldn't end up with these disasters if, in fact, you had everything arranged in your lifestyle and in the culture of a sustainable lifestyle. Just you had some really interesting comments about that. Could you remember what you said?
So I spent about 35 years before coming to Chatham working in this field of international disaster response all around the world, about 30-something countries we worked in. So in famines, after earthquakes, after civil wars, those sorts of things. And really, all of those are the result of unsustainable development, where it's politically or economically or in terms of the natural resource base. So when you start to think about a sustainable economy and society, there's a lot of asking what if. You know, what if we get that 1-in-100-year flood? How are we going to protect ourselves? How do we tweak our economy so we're not absolutely reliant on one product? We don't want to have any more Flint, Michigans or Detroits that, you know, get rid of one product, the motor car, and your economy's gone. Well, you don't have to be a Nobel laureate in economics to understand only having one shot in your rifle is no good, right? You need more than that. So really what I see myself doing here, and the faculty and the staff and the students, is trying to create the type of systems and understand what society needs to be like to make sure that as we move into this period where we know things like climate change are just going to radically change how our country works. So it's a period of great uncertainty. We could have a lot more crises. But if we start to build our country in a more sustainable way, the likelihood of that happening recedes. We actually build a better future, not just for us, but for our kids and for future generations.
How long is it going to take, and how many schools like yours is it going to require for that to happen?
That's a good question. Actually, I'm more optimistic than I used to be because I see how quickly change can take place. Let me give you a little example. One of the bane of people's lives when you think about sustainability is the motor car. It eats gasoline, it generates carbon dioxide, and you probably haven't thought about it like this, but that second biggest purchase in your life after your house, 90% of its time is spent sitting on your driveway rusting, right? I mean, how crazy is that? And there was no obvious way out of it because everybody wants that flexibility. But now, with the advent of driverless cars coming online soon and schemes like Uber and some of these sharing schemes, what the car companies are looking at now is a future in which they don't sell you a car, But they basically run a great big rental fleet of self-drive cars, and whenever you need one, you just order it up on your phone, and they will guarantee within 1 minute you will have a car there that will take you wherever you want to go. You don't have to park it. You don't have to worry about servicing it. You're effectively buying a share in it. And it increases the efficiency of transport many, many folds. And you just could not have thought of that as a solution 10 years ago. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if we're seeing examples of that within 10 years' time. And we're seeing changes. The students we get are not just the, I want to say, the tree-hugging hippies of the past. They're people who are quite hard-nosed. They want to start their own businesses, right? They want to build a society in which they're not as obsessed about owning lots of things because, you know, why would I own a car when I can just rent one when I need it? Why would I own a huge TV in my house when actually I want to watch most of the stuff when I'm on the go and I just want an iPad? You know, it's a very different, I think, mentality. So I'm actually quite optimistic.
Well, I promise we'll come back. Maybe we'll only wait 5 years, and we'll find out if this super world that you're trying to create a little bit off here at Chatham University, and what's the name of the campus we have?
Eden
Hall. The Eden Hall campus. You're not world famous yet, but I have a feeling you're going to be very quickly. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And of course, it takes more than one person to run a project, even a person as energetic and skillful and thoughtful as Peter Walker. So he's got a few people on board helping him make sure that the program is successful. And one of them, not surprisingly, I guess, is a chef who mans a kitchen, which is not just a wonderful kitchen, but it's actually a commercial operation where even as a member of the public you can go to eat. And as a student, you would certainly be very well fed. So first of all, we're going to talk to Chef Chris, and then it's those Jamisons again.
Yeah, they're good folks.
Suki and John applying their 35 years of knowledge about how to deal with sheep.
And more energy than I'll ever have.
Yeah, and they took on the task of running a meat program as part of the food. What is it? Food studies program.
Sustainability. Yeah.
So they talk about that, how they're teaching the art of managing livestock as part of the program the students enjoy. So first of all, the chef, and then the Jamisons, and then that'll be the end of today's program.
At the Eden Hall. And a very important part of this program is, of course, the food aspect of it. So we went right to the top here, the head chef, Christopher Galarza, who is the from Parkhurst Dining Group, but you were in charge of all the food studies here?
I am not in charge of the food studies here. I work in conjunction with them. We are a separate dining facility. We're contract dining. So we are contracted by the university to do their dining. But I, like, this place is such a special place, I try to take it a step further. So I work with the students. I like to find out what they like what their moms made. Actually, I have a student. Her name is Tenzin. When she first got, she's an exchange student from, or a foreign student from India. And she came here. She was really, really homesick. And, you know, we got to talking, and she did not want to be around here. She wanted to go back home. She missed her family. But my staff and I got close with her, and we were trying to make her feel more at home. So she started coming around for lunch, and she would sit down for lunch with us. And then we decided to make an Indian-themed lunch. So we found out what days she was on campus, and we made an Indian-themed lunch every 2 or 3 weeks, and made her feel at home. Got the recipes that her mom used to make, and she loves it. She even told one of my staff, Peggy, that she cooks better than her mom, but I should not have said that.
Well, explain this program to me. Are you primarily here to teach the students about food or about cooking or about both? And you also feed the students and actually it's open to the public? Is that the concept?
Yes, it's open to the public. So anyone can just walk in off the street and come and grab some food. It's very reasonably priced. Our breakfast is $5.75, lunch is $7.25, and dinner is $8.25. And it's all you care to eat. Desserts, salad, the whole nine. As far as the students go, I am not a professor here, but I am going to be start working on a little curriculum. The students have this little convection toaster oven, so I'm going to get that and come up with some innovative and creative dishes that they can make that's healthy, it's cheap, and can keep them sustained while we're not in operation.
We're sitting in this facility, Christopher, and I must tell you, it is spectacular. It's the kitchen. And you have every toy that any chef would want. And it cost a fortune, didn't it, building it? You just opened it and just had the dedication, right?
Yes, it did. It does cost a pretty penny to do something of this size. It's mind-boggling, but it was done responsibly. And what I mean by that is, like, for instance, our range, it uses 50% less energy than any other range as opposed to a gas range, for instance. Our hood vent system, it costs three times the amount to be put in, but in energy savings alone, will pay itself off in 14 months. I can go into how it works if you have time.
Well,
do you have time for all that?
I think it's a bit too technical. That's not my strong point.
Understood.
But I do understand that your induction, how many induction plates do you have?
We have about 10 to 12 induction plates that are meant for warming. And as far as cooking goes, we have two in the teaching kitchen and eight for regular service.
So you're going to develop a curriculum. You use whatever is available on the farm.
Yes.
And you're eventually, I understand, going to get animals to work with too.
That is the dream of a lot of people on campus. I myself would love to have, like, cattle grown on campus. Goat, where we get our cheese from. Actually, as far as working with what we've got, we, for instance, Dean Luann Caligiuri, I don't know if you've met her, she gave me a little bit of a challenge, which was to come up with some dishes using knotweed, which is a weed. It's a Japanese knotweed. It's very invasive. And so we had a meeting up here with a bunch of really higher-ups, and I made a rhubarb and knotweed salad dressing for them, and that was the only thing they talked about. They had Faroe Island salmon. They had a lot of great stuff there. The only thing they talked about was the dressing. And then after I told her what it was, she was completely beside herself.
Yeah, you mentioned Sifu. You also have aquaculture, an aquapon. It's just an amazing thing. If I walked in off the street tonight for dinner, what would you be offering?
If you walked in off the street tonight, well, one, unfortunately, we're closed. But we do, going back to the aquaponics, we did have, it wasn't an event, kind of. We had some fish in there just to try out the system. It was trout. So they gave me the trout that day. That day we had it broken down. And we did trout meniere with rye berry pilaf with carrot puree. And roasted tricolor carrots. And that's what the students had for dinner. So they're not eating typical cafeteria food. They eat the best food you can have at this budget, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, you teach them how to cut fish and things like that?
No, they have their own. They have a meats course. The fish was just a was just a test. We just wanted to see how it worked in the system, and then we wanted to see how the process coming to the table was.
Well, I think you have an amazing facility to work with here, and it would be the kind of place I'd like to come and play.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is truly my Garden of Eden.
Well, thank you for taking time to talk to us. Oh, Peter has a question.
It all sounds like such a great idea, but we always worry about motives. I mean, what's the motivation for Parkhurst? Are they simply being a good member of the community, or are there some elements of what you're doing here that they expect will make their operations more successful and more profitable?
Well, as far as what we're doing here, it's not unique to this, to what we do. We have a farm source program in which we have a guy, his name is Jamie Moore. He's the director of sourcing and sustainability. So he goes out to farms every day to see how their operations work, to see how, if they're following our standards in order to even sell to us. Like we live sustainability as a company. Even the Eaton Park stores, they are going towards more local, more farm-steady food, which you don't see in any other company. Like we do take the time to make sure things are done right, because, yeah, it could be all about money. We can cut corners, but that's not what it's about. It's about making sure we get the best possible products, from making your own stocks in-house, from making your own everything we can in-house. We make our own jams and jellies, our own desserts, our own... We even have our own flour that's milled on site.
But, I mean, you're a part of that team, or are you just stationed out here?
Well, I've only been a part of the company since July, so I'm coming up on my first year, and I'm hoping to use the experience I have here to be able to give more insight. But they seem to be doing a phenomenal job without me.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. This is a very quiet kitchen, I guess, because there are no students here, so there's nobody to cook for.
Yeah.
It sounds like they're very well taken care of, and we thank you for telling us all about that.
Absolutely, and this place, people should really take the time to come out here, because it really truly is an inspiration. It's awe-inspiring, and it's beautiful.
We're going to be talking to John and Suki Jamison of Jamison Farm. And do we call it Latrobe? What do we call it?
Yes, our Jamison Farm is in Latrobe, yes.
Okay. And you are an organic lamb grower, but you also have a processing plant, and you process other animals too, right?
Right. We process our own lambs, and then we process beef and pigs for other customers.
Now, the thing is that we're doing this, I think it's a really unique operation, an effort of sustainability with Falk School of Sustainability and the Eden Hall campus, which we recently toured. And we found out that they have this glorious new kitchen, but that's not actually where they don't teach cooking there. But the whole meat program is, I guess, subcontracted to the Jamisons, am I correct?
That's right.
And what does that meat program consist of?
Well, we have 5 weeks now, or five?
Right.
It's sessions.
It's part of a semester, one semester. So it meets five times.
Right. And the first one, I go in and tell all the stories that you've heard about 10 times about all the famous chefs that I fight with and have fun with, and how famous we are and all that stuff. And then
I got started 35 years ago.
Well, you are. I mean, you are famous.
How we've managed to stay alive, and as far as the business, and then during that, at the end of the talk, talk about to them, to the students, about what to expect next, and the fact that if they are looking at this, they should understand the process of meat production all the way through, from slaughter to hanging and cutting, aging, and then cutting, and then any further processing that may be done, meaning making soups or stews or sausage. And so that's the first session. And then the second session, which is 2 weeks later, the students come to the processing plant, and we slaughter lambs that day, and then they kind of, that's awakening.
Yeah,
that awakening is the what is what's ahead of them. And
you start with live animals, John. You have live lambs, and you actually slaughter them in front of the students.
Right.
Good. So that's probably the first time they've ever seen anything like it, huh?
Right, it is. It is the first time. And what we try to explain to them is that there is a way to do it correctly, and that's how we do it. And when we also have great respect for the animal. And so they see it really the way it should be done. And then, and then the following weeks, we go into those carcasses and break them down into cuts and also sausage and soup. So I'm going to have Suki talk about this. One of the things that we do that Sally Fry, who's involved with the course, one of the instructors, she was very, very impressed at the fact that we break everything down and then show what those cuts are used for. So you explain that, please.
We took a carcass and cut it into the retail cuts, and then we put it all back together so that it would look like a carcass again. But then as we did that, we pointed out which cuts you use for which kind of cooking that kind of thing. So that was pretty effective as far as them getting to understand where the meat comes from, where it comes from on the animal.
Right.
A lot of them had never seen anything like that, of course, and then why it's important if it comes from the leg of lamb or the back of the lamb, which we call the whole back, which would be the rack and the saddle together, which John calls high on the hog, which is what it is.
Yeah, high on the hog. That's why it came to be called high on the hog, by the way, right? That's why we have the phrase high on the hog.
Yeah, because exactly. So that's really the basis of this whole thing is that the middle meats, which with lamb would be the loin chops and the rack, or if it were beef, it would be the T-bone, porterhouse, Delmonico, and then the prime rib. On any animal, that's the most expensive cuts, the middle meats.
Yeah.
And they're the easy, well, not the easiest to cook necessarily, but the fastest to cook because those muscles just sit there and get fat and wonderful. And so that's kind of the basis of what we're trying to teach. The reason that it's when the stock market's good and everybody's happy, they eat high on the hog because they're eating those middle meats.
Now, is this course sufficient for the students to actually learn how to cut up a carcass themselves, or if they're interested in that, they would have to do more studying?
Well, they probably have to do more. We give them a demonstration. We also ask them, some participate, and if they, you know, you have to be very cautious, of course, because you don't know whether anybody has knife skills or not. And
a
sharp weapon. So we have to be very careful that way. But we will have them, like I show them how to French a rack, and then I give a rack to them and say, okay, you do it.
Now, what do you
do? Exactly, boy.
It takes my guys a couple minutes to do it, and it took them like 20 minutes because... You know, you have to get a technique. You have to figure out what it is you're doing and really dive right in and get into it. And they like doing that because a lot of the girls, mostly, and what I find amazing of all the classes we've had, it's they're 90% women.
Really?
Now,
yeah.
Interesting enough, now, what, after you've cut all these animals up, what happens? Do you have a big cookout?
Well, actually, we do. At the end of the last class, we... After we go through, we do the classes at the plant, and then we have a class on HACCP talking about the USDA and all that kind of thing that's very important at our plant to make it run properly. we have the last classes held here at the farm, and we show them the farm and the fields and all that kind of stuff, and then we cook lunch. We take some of the cuts and cook them.
Uh-huh.
And,
thank goodness
for
that.
Have a potluck lunch, and that's our... That's what we call it, our final exam.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
It sounds like a lot of fun, too.
It is
a lot of fun. And we came up with the idea, really, because it's they call it experiential learning.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of learning that you can't get unless you put your hands on it and do it. You can watch a video, but it's not the same thing as getting in there and getting dirty with it.
Right. You introduced, the sustainable raising of animals and everything, too. John does that to start with?
Right. We talk about that. When he gives the history of the farm, we talk about how we got started and all that kind of stuff. Then they see it themselves by coming here and seeing our rotational grazing and the lambs outside and all that.
Yeah, I explain the basics of intensive rotational grazing. Why it works and how it works and how to fatten animals on it. And then the way the timing usually works is by the time they get here, we're rotating more than we are early on, because early on they're still eating bales of hay because it's in the winter. It starts in February.
The class starts the end of January.
End of January.
Ends in the middle of April.
I see. No, well, I mean, I think a class from you, little experts in this, is worth the whole tuition at this place.
We hope they think so. A lot of them, after their first class at the plant, you don't know what they're going to think, but they all come back. So
yeah, they do. They have so far.
That's great. I mean, they're thinking down the line, apparently, of having animals on the grounds of the campus, the whole campus, but there's concern about who would actually take care of the animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, well. Anyhow, this is very fascinating, and I think you mentioned that you're famous, that giggled, but you actually are. Anytime anybody writes a book about how we've advanced in sustainability and quality of meat in this country, they mention you, John and Suki. And so you are famous. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
It was great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, as always.
And that's all we have for today's program.
Yeah,
so
I'd like to add one thing.
Go ahead, please.
In every one of these listicles and news things, they always have a category called one to watch. And I think that we're talking at the very beginning of this program, the Falk Sustainability School and the Eden Hall campus. But it's going great. It's going to go even greater, and it's going to have graduate students. I mean, it's an amazing place to watch.
And, of course, we'll bring them back to you when they have more interesting news to report.
Right.
So until this time next week, same time, same place, we hope you'll join us again. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.